The Orange FM.
Welcome to another episode of Bad Wolf Radio, a discussion and review podcast all about Doctor Who. I am one of your hosts, Aaron Goins, and I'm here with a man who is already sewing a bright red lining into his favorite jacket, Adam Farmer.
Nice. I do like that one. That's a good one. I do have a, well, what I thought was a black coat upstairs, but after looking at it a little bit more, I think we've decided it's not necessarily black, is it?
Oh, the doctor's coat? Yeah, it's navy blue, I believe.
Yeah, that kind of caught me off guard. I guess I can't tell my blues from my blacks, because as I stare at it a little bit more, I'm starting to see the blue come through.
Yeah, so as you're kind of alluding to, there has been some big news that has broken about the new season, or the new doctor, more specifically, and that is that we know what he's going to be wearing now.
Yeah, we talked about it a bit on our last episode, that there wasn't much to talk about. Some of the pictures had already come out. He was in his PJs, but we didn't really know, or we were hoping that wasn't the costume he was going to be donning for the entire tenure as the Doctor. But lo and behold, in the 2 weeks that it took us to come to this one, we now know what he's going to be wearing.
Definitely. So let's talk about it. Let's make that kind of our discussion topic to start the show out. What did you think about the outfit when you first saw it? Like, what was your first reaction?
Honestly, my first reaction was, oh my goodness, we already know what he's going to be wearing. We aren't anywhere close to being to the fall, when everything is going to start picking up speed and the episodes start airing. But yet, here we are, only 3 weeks into the new year, and we already know what he's wearing. But then after I got over the shock of already seeing what it was, I can't say that I was disappointed. I know that there was some disappointment out there, but I kind of like the direction it's going.
Yeah, my first reaction was, that looks sleek. You know, it looks good. I liked it. But then as I started to look a little bit closer and kind of look at the details of it and start to think about, you know, what I'm used to seeing on the Doctor, I began to question my initial opinion. So, I mean, I kind of started to think, is this too plain? Like, the Doctor has always had some sort of flair. You know, there's always some sort of distinctive element about his costume. And this seems to kind of be missing that.
It definitely doesn't have the punch that a lot of the Doctors have or had. It doesn't have the long multicolored scarf. It doesn't have the ruffles of the shirt underneath. It doesn't have the fez or the bow tie. You don't have the pinstripe coat. But looking at the outfit, it definitely looks, it's not something that you would see someone running around with on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you have the red lining, which I think is awesome. It definitely adds a little bit more to it. But even the length of the coat, I dig that. The coat is an awesome length for what looks to be, I don't know, it goes back and forth. Is it a trench coat? Is it a suit coat? But I think it looks good.
It seems like they're kind of trying to make him to be a completely different Doctor than we're used to, especially with what we had with Smith. So they went with an outfit that's completely different than what Smith wore, which, you know, kind of makes sense. And it suits Capaldi. It looks good on him. He wears it well.
Yeah, he does. It's a departure from what we're used to. And it might be the new direction that we're seeing with the Doctor. I mean, he's gone from kind of the goofy persona that we've seen, the funny quirks, the interesting personalities, and it seems like they're cutting a different line on this one and kind of taking a no-nonsense approach. He's very simple, but yet it's distinctive to me. It definitely sticks out, but it has a more serious appeal to it. One thing that kind of struck me, and it's one thing I can't get get past his top button is buttoned, but there's nothing up there. I wanted to think for the longest time that maybe there's just a white tie there that I can't see, but the fact that it's all buttoned up and there's nothing there with it, that's kind of throwing me off, but it's still interesting. It just makes him look very, very straight-laced.
I think it'd be better than a white tie, though.
I don't know. You can rock a white tie every now and then. That would be that distinctive aspect that you'd be looking for.
Maybe. White ties are cool.
He could make them cool.
So what do you think? Because I kind of posted on our Facebook page, you know, that I thought it was plain. I was like, where's the distinctive element? Smith had his bow tie and Tennant had the tennis shoes. You know, where's the distinctive element that we can relate to this costume? And a lot of people were pointing out, well, it's the red lining of the coat. You know, do you buy that? Do you think that's enough?
I think it might be enough to say that the distinctive element is that it's not like any of the other doctors. There's not something that pops out and says, oh, there you go. That's his personality. It might be the lack of something that makes it distinctive to this doctor. It might be the lack of that outrageous personality that kind of sets this doctor apart from all the rest of them.
I'm kind of looking for the cosplay, you know, like if I'm going to a convention and I see somebody walk by as the 12th doctor, am I going to even recognize it? Like it was easy with, you know, everybody walking by with the bow ties and the fez or the pinstripe suit and the tennis shoes, you know, that was easy. You know, okay, that guy's dressed up as the doctor, but now it's going to be kind of a guessing game. Like, okay, that guy's wearing a blue coat and black pants. Maybe he's the doctor.
you might think that he's pulling off a very poor Dracula.
Yeah, or as some people said on Facebook, he looks like a magician.
See, that's kind of rough. I wouldn't go that far. I get maybe if you threw a top hat on him, he would kind of pull off the magician vibe, and he had like a hanky hanging out of his pocket.
Might be the pose that he's striking in that official photo they released. Something about that pose. I think you had said it was the Spider-Man pose.
Yeah, it looks like he's about to sling some web.
I was thinking it looked like he was trying to use the force, but like that's just not a natural pose for the doctor. What is he doing with his hand there?
Very interesting that you take the Star Wars route and I go with Marvel.
And I guess the other thing I was kind of thinking that's missing is the Sonic. And do you think that maybe they're just kind of keeping that a secret, like they don't want to show us what the Sonic is, what the Sonic's going to look like? Or do you think there's a possibility that this doctor may not actually use a Sonic? I know some doctors in the past didn't.
The Sonic has become such a big part of the show here recently that I'd find it very hard to believe if Moffat decided to ditch the Sonic altogether. In fact, because each of the modern doctors has had their own look to the Sonic, I would say that they're probably just keeping that one under wraps for a little bit longer. Or at least I hope so. I hope it's tucked in his pocket.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense. That's one collectible that they wouldn't be able to sell. So money-wise, it makes sense for them that he would have a Sonic, so they have another item that they could sell on ThinkGeek or wherever they sell those things.
Yeah, I'm still looking to get the Sonic that controls my TV. I know it's out there, and it's just a matter of locating it and purchasing it, because I think that'd be really cool to have a 10th Doctor Sonic that controls my television.
Okay, so let's just, what's our verdict then? Or at least each of us can give our opinion. Are you thumbs up or thumbs down on this outfit?
I'm thumbs up. It's, yes, it lacks that frill of all the other Doctors that we've seen to this point. But because of what I think as the direction they're going with this doctor, the more serious approach and kind of what I'm hoping the story becomes or the attitude this doctor portrays, I'm willing to let this one ride and kind of enjoy my scheming until I see the first episode air.
Yeah, for me, it did kind of remind me of the third doctor. I was talking to a guy at work about it, and I kind of had mentioned to him, I said, it looks like the third doctor, except without all the frills. And he had mentioned, well, the third doctor had a cape, and I had kind of forgotten that. So I went online and I saw some people had already started comparing the third doctor to this outfit, and the third doctor's cape actually has a bright red lining in it. It's interesting to think maybe this is a purposeful, you know, throwback to that. You know, he's got a similar outfit. He's got this jacket with a red lining that, you know, kind of is a throwback to the cape with the red lining. So if that's purposeful, I think that's kind of cool that Moffat would, reference the third Doctor in that way, and I kind of hope it is on purpose. But in the end, I actually do like it. I think it suits Capaldi. I think he looks good in it, and it's different, which I was hoping for something different with this Doctor, so I can't complain.
Awesome. Should we stay on the Capaldi train of thought on this one and talk a little bit about the fires of Pompeii, another thing that has shown up on our Facebook page?
Definitely. So I had heard a lot of people talking when Capaldi first got announced. A lot of people were saying, oh, he's already been in Doctor Who. And I, for the life of me, didn't remember that he was in Doctor Who. I didn't even know who he was. And then people would say, oh, he was in the episode The Fires of Pompeii. And I tried to remember back, like thinking, okay, maybe he was just a character that was in the background, or maybe he didn't have a speaking role, but I really didn't remember him. So I decided to go back and actually watch that episode, just kind of remind me of exactly, how big of a part did he play. And when I went back and watched it, I was surprised that the character he plays actually has a pretty big role in the episode. And I know you rewatched the episode recently as well. And I was kind of surprised how big of a part he did play. And he had a lot of lines. He was an important character in that story. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And it kind of started making me think, oh, well, I always try to figure things out, like, in universe. What's the explanation? Why is this guy have the same face as the Doctor is gonna have when he's the 12th Doctor? So I, of course, started coming up with all these theories that maybe, is there any possible way that he is the Doctor, at that point? Or maybe a more likely theory is maybe the Doctor, because he met this guy, is reusing his face, or when he regenerates, he, I don't know, probably not purposefully, but subconsciously his body is regenerating as people he has met before. So I kind of started to think about it, like, how could he be the Doctor? Because I think that'd be really cool if they figured out a way that he actually is the Doctor at that point. And so I remembered that there was these episodes where the Doctor actually became human. Do you remember those episodes? The ones where he was the teacher?
Yes, when he was John Smith, I believe.
Yes. So he's running from these people, these aliens that are trying to kill him and Martha. He, as a defense mechanism, because I guess they can track him because he's a Time Lord or something like that. He has this device on the TARDIS and this little watch that he's able to make himself human, and then I guess his essence is kind of stored in this watch, and then if the watch is ever opened, then he will remember that he's the Doctor. But if the watch isn't opened, he thinks he's human. He has no idea that he's a doctor, and his actual biology has been changed to be human. Do you remember all this?
Yes, yep.
Okay. So I was thinking, well, maybe the 12th doctor at some point had to do the same thing and had to make himself human as a defense mechanism, ends up in Pompeii and becomes a marble salesman. And there we go. We get the doctor, actually the 10th doctor, saving his own life unknowingly from the fires of Pompeii. What do you think, Adam? Am I crazy?
Yes, I don't want to. I don't want to ride that train. That being said, rewatching the episode and kind of knowing what you are trying to make a case for, there's a lot of interesting things. For one, there's some weird exchanges of just awkward glances between both doctors, at times. So at the end,
So you're saying he is the doctor?
I don't know. I don't want to, no, he's not. Honestly, if they go back and they try to retcon that and make that the truth, I think I will have huge issues with that. But I can see how they could, because there's this weird locket that Capaldi's son throughout the episode wears on his person. To me, it's one of those things that it's like, okay, you could say that's pretty much the exact same thing as the fob watch that Tennant had. So maybe the son was just keeping it safe at some point.
See, I didn't even notice that, and that just strengthens my case.
I know, right? I don't want to do that for you, but it's a possibility. And especially, I think I've read things where Moffat said that this is something that might be played out throughout the next season. I'm looking for it right now to see if I could find any credence to what I'm saying,
I
but
believe he did say in an interview that the resemblance of Capaldi to this character is not a coincidence, and that there will be some sort of an explanation for it.
Yeah, and I am of the mindset, honestly, it's a funny coincidence. I would rather not have an explanation. I would rather just ignore the fact that it ever happened, enjoy the fires of Pompeii for what it is, realizing that it was filmed how many years before Capaldi was ever announced as the Doctor, and then just enjoy Capaldi's ride from here. I don't want to try to make it make sense. That being said, if Moffat doesn't want to ignore it, I completely understand. But I thought it was hilarious as I was rewatching the episode and I see his son carrying around a little locket the entire time on his chest that looks very much like what it could be a fob watch, and just thinking of what that might do for your theory.
I don't think that's going to be the case. I think it would be cool if they tied it in and figured out, you know, a way to say, hey, that actually was the Doctor at that time. I don't think they'll go there. I think it will probably be more of kind of what I was saying before. You know, the Doctor met him. You know, they actually, I think as he's saving his life, as Pompeii is burning, the Doctor comes back. Donna basically guilts the Doctor into going back and saving these people. And as he's saving them, there's this scene where he reaches his hand out and then Capaldi reaches his hand out. I think I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, you are.
And they like grab each other's hands. And I was thinking, okay, there's some kind of connection there, and maybe the Doctor, his Time Lord self, has kind of remembered the imprint of this person, and then when he regenerated, he, you know, regenerated into that likeness. So I could see that being the explanation, much more likely than it actually being the Doctor.
Yeah, I could see that one, especially with what they've done or what they've tried to do with the idea of the Scottish accent and kind of coming from Rose and so forth with that. So I could see more of the visual aspect of his appearance being imprinted on his Time Lord memory, and that's where the resemblance came from. But one thing I did notice from watching the Fires of Pompeii, and you can call me crazy, and I'm trying to see if there's some way I can splice some pictures together, but Capaldi in that episode looks strangely like Rory. There's something about the resemblance that it's just, it took me all of 5 minutes of watching him on screen to make that connection, but I swear he looks like Rory.
I don't see it, but you know, I'll take your word for it. I'll have to look at some pictures side by side and see if I can compare them, but there's an age difference there. I think it'd be hard for them to really resemble each other.
There's a picture that I'll need to show you. It looks pretty darn close if you look at it, and maybe get rid of the funky hair.
Okay, I'll check it out. But so you're telling me that it wasn't Amy Pond that was part of that soothsayers or whatever in the Fires of Pompeii?
No, it was not Amy.
Not Amy Pond. I'm going to figure out a way that was her as well.
She's the one that already turned to stone.
No. You do, like, the actress that played Amy is in that episode.
Is she really?
You didn't notice that?
No, you're kidding
me. The very first, like, that group of women, and I forget what they were called, that were kind of like, you know, they were turning to stone, they were, you know, seeing the future and all that stuff. The very first one that spots the Doctor, with the one with the red hair, is...
Karen Gillian?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Seriously?
Yep.
Oh, so my goodness.
Not
it
only
is
do
her.
We, not only do we have Peter Capaldi in that episode before he was the Doctor, but we also have Karen Gillian in there before she was Amy Pond.
How in the world have I never known that?
Yeah, so... So there you go.
Okay, that has officially become one of the most amazing Doctor Who episodes ever.
And it is a really good episode.
Yeah, it's a really good episode, but the fact that it's all timey-wimey now just makes it even better.
Yeah, so I think there should be some very, you know, intricate story that Moffat comes up where that's actually the Doctor and that's actually Amy. I don't know. I think it'd be cool. I don't think they'll do it, but...
The Weeping Angel sent her further back than what they thought.
Yeah, and then aren't they like covering their faces kind of the way that weeping angels do too?
That's actually very true.
Yeah.
Because they have those eyes drawn on the other side of their hands.
So let's not fall any deeper into this well, but.
Oh man, we're getting all fan fiction geeky on this.
Yeah, I'm already halfway through my fan fiction. But yeah, so I thought that was cool. Good episodes to go back and watch if you're, you know, if you're a fan of Doctor Who and you haven't seen The Fires of Pompeii in a while. I definitely recommend go back, check it out. It actually gives you a lot of screen time with Peter Capaldi, which is cool because you get to see kind of his personality, and I think maybe give you an indication of maybe what we could expect from him as the Doctor.
Yeah, I agree. I was blown away by the episode, and I was reminded why I loved that specific episode so much.
It's never forgotten, Caecilius. Oh, time will pass. Men will move on and stories will fade, but one day, Pompeii will be found again. In thousands of years. And everyone will remember you.
Let's move on, and we are going to move on to kind of what we've been doing, the classic episodes. We've gone back. We're going to review the classic episodes that are available on Hulu Plus. So if you listened to last week or last episode, I guess it wasn't last week, but last episode, you heard us review the first four episodes of the classic Doctor, or the first Doctor, the classic series. So now we are going to review the next serial or the next storyline entitled The Daleks. Are you excited about this, Adam?
I was, yeah.
I was.
It was one of those things. We talked about it last episode where we had the opportunity not only to meet the first Doctor with the first arc, but we have the opportunity now to meet possibly one of the most notorious villains of Doctor Who. So I was super excited just to see how everything panned out, their interactions, and kind of glean from that history.
So we have, these are episodes 5 through 11 of the first season of classic Doctor Who. And the titles, we'll just kind of go through the titles now. The titles of the episodes are The Dead Planet, The Survivors, The Escape, The Ambush, The Expedition, The Ordeal, and The Rescue. So let's talk about the first episode. We have the Doctor and his newfound companions landing on a planet that is not Earth, which I thought was kind of cool because it's only their second adventure together, and they have already left Earth. So this is Ian and Barbara's first, you know, chance to step on another planet's soil.
I thought that was cool as well because it's not only not Earth, but it just so happens to be a planet that you hear so much about when it comes to the Daleks, Skaro. So it was really cool to, I mean, you aren't aware of that at first, and actually you have to get a couple episodes in. Since there are seven of them, you have to get a couple episodes in to kind of gather that it is Skaro. But it's really cool to know that this entire story arc took place on that planet.
Yeah, it's definitely cool to see, you know, some of these elements of Doctor Who that we're so familiar with, to kind of see their beginnings. And that is something that I will say about these episodes that I did really enjoy, was kind of learning the history of the Daleks. So basically, they're on this planet. They realize that the forest is petrified, the forest that they land in. And the companions are like, okay, let's get out of here. You know, they don't want to stay on this planet. But the Doctor is kind of a jerk and is like, no, I want to go and research the city that they see. Which I thought was kind of interesting because he was so concerned with going in and researching the city, even though it was unsafe to be on that planet.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting too, because you, again, like we discussed in the last episode, there's a weird dynamic going on right now between the Doctor and his companions. That's, the Doctor doesn't want him around, and to be quite honest, the companions, outside of his granddaughter, obviously, both Ian and Barbara are kind of wanting something to happen to him. They don't have very fond feelings towards the Doctor at this point.
Yeah, Barbara says something like, I think Ian said something about the Doctor being careful, and then Barbara's like, I kind of want something to happen to him because he deserves it.
I hate it as much as you. I'm just as afraid. But what can we do?
Well, we could at least stay near the ship.
The ship's no good without him. We better keep an eye on him. He seems to have a knack of getting himself into trouble.
You think there's any danger?
Not necessarily.
But don't be too complacent. No, you're right, I suppose. I just wish...
We'll be all right.
Well, I suppose we'd better make sure he doesn't fall down and break a leg. Don't you ever think he deserves something to happen to him?
Yes.
You know, I guess that kind of makes sense. They literally have been kidnapped by this guy, and now have been taken to this planet that he doesn't want to leave because he wants to go into the city and research it, and it's all, and they're kind of being held hostage. So I think I could understand maybe why they haven't really warmed up to him yet.
Yeah, I wonder how long before Stockholm Syndrome sets in.
We'll find out, I guess. I'm really hoping that they kind of that they start to portray the Doctor a little bit differently, because across all of these episodes, he's still just such a jerk. And it's really hard to root for him or to think of him even as the main character. I still, you know, throughout these episodes, I still kind of saw Ian as the star of the show and not really the Doctor.
It's one of those things where there are those shining moments where it's like, okay, that is a bit or a piece of the Doctor that we have come to know. But he definitely feels like he has a lot of layers to work through before we get to that point. We're on the receiving end, I guess, of season after season of evolution for the Doctor. And we're just kind of getting back to the rustic roots, if you will.
Another thing I noticed that was on the TARDIS was this food processor that he has, where he can actually, you know, they said they wanted bacon and eggs and he can put that into the machine. You know, he had Susan dial in some code, and then it spits out this cube, and then they have this food. And I was like, where did that thing go? Why doesn't the current Doctor have a food processor in his TARDIS?
I was really hoping that someone would ask for a souffle. I don't know why. Well, I know why, but I knew that there wasn't a good chance, but I was really hoping that Barbara or Ian would ask for a souffle at that point, and out would pop a little square of a souffle for them to try. I did think it was cool, though. He still has to have it. I mean, with all the companions he's had and how much he's traveled, it still has to be tucked in there somewhere, but it might just be in the swimming pool or the library.
It's got to be by the pool. Everything's by the pool, it seems like.
Exactly. We just need one of those maps. Well, the TARDIS changes so much. Who knows?
So we have the Doctor, and he acts like basically he wants to study the city. The companions want to leave. So he goes into the TARDIS and acts like he's going to leave. And then something happens to the TARDIS, and you see the Doctor kind of go under there and like pull out something, but it's not very clear like if he's purposely trying to sabotage the TARDIS. But, you know, later on we do find out that he actually did purposely sabotage the TARDIS. I thought that was interesting that he would go to those lengths just to stay on this planet.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those moments where it's like you see him duck down there, and you know it would be impossible for everybody else on the TARDIS to miss the fact that he just ducked down there. He pops back up, flips a few switches, and then is like, oh darn, what just happened? And then he drops back down there and he pulls something out. It's like, oh, wait a second here. Something's not right. But yeah, he definitely wanted his own way. He wanted to do what he wanted to do despite what everybody else thought would be the best. And this is after Susan swears that someone or something touched her in the woods.
Yeah, we get the classic Susan freak out, but we don't really find anything else out about that until later on, I think.
Right.
So they decide to go to the city. They go to the city. There's these weird doors that pop open. They just go inside. And then Barbara gets separated somehow. And then, boom, we get to see the very first image of a Dalek. You see the plunger kind of coming at you. And then they dramatically end the episode.
Yes. Now let's rewind a little bit, because they get there and very strange city. None of them by this point are feeling well. Something's going on, which they found a metal box outside the TARDIS that they decided to stick inside the TARDIS and just leave it there, thinking that someone random just dropped it off there, which is interesting. I always heard that you weren't supposed to take anything from strangers, but it's the 60s. Who knows? So they get to the city, and they're looking for Mercury, and they decide, strange city, strange planet, really weird things have been happening, let's split up.
Like, yeah. Why would you just assume this alien planet's going to have Mercury on it? Is that like a, I don't know, maybe that's just a standard element that most planets have.
I guess. I mean, everybody needs to keep track of their temperature. Maybe they're going to break a few thermometers.
And he's like, look for a laboratory. I'm like, how do we even know these people have laboratories?
How do we even know that there were people here?
So we move on to the second episode, and we have this, you know, they're starting to feel this effects of the radiation sickness. as they called it. And I started to think, like, okay, they're on this planet that has been completely irradiated. These people would be dead. I mean, maybe the Time Lords have a different physiology that can survive such things, but Ian and Barbara would have been dead. I mean, you don't walk around in radiation like that and survive.
Yeah, it was funny because when they first, well, they find their Mercury and they're in the room that has all the gauges and stuff, and there's the they called it a Geiger counter. It didn't look much like a Geiger counter to me, but I what do I know? But it was this box that had the needle on it, and honestly, I swear it was just a piece of paper over top of it that said danger. And that's where the needle was pointing. So yeah, the radiation levels were so high that it was in the danger zone, and you think it would have a greater impact on them. But they were all expiring pretty quickly. They seemed like they were starting to feel the effects pretty bad.
Yeah, and I bought into that. It's like, okay, the radiation is making them very sick, which is, very accurate. That would happen. But the fact that you can just go get some medicine that's going to fix you, typically the effects of radiation on the human body is, cell deterioration. You don't just build those cells back up just because it takes some medicine.
But this is not just any medicine you're forgetting.
That's true.
This is foul medicine.
Yes, that's true. This is not just any medicine. This is medicine from people that have figured out how to survive on this planet. So, yeah, maybe it's some kind of advanced medicine that is beyond our understanding and can rebuild cells and can save you from radiation.
So it gets to the point where they're all locked up, right? They're all stuck in their prison cell, and they go back and forth, and they hear the Daleks talking about other people. Well, the doctor is interviewed by them and other people, and they just come to the conclusion that the Thals, that this other people have left the radiation medicine, and that's the silver box that they've found outside the TARDIS when they first left. So they have to decide who should go.
Of all the people that you would want to go get the medicine that would save your life, we send the level-headed Susan Foreman.
Well, for good reason.
They didn't really have
Ian,
much option.
yeah, Ian had just been shot by the Dalek and was paralyzed from pretty much the waist down, which
Yeah.
he was all pins and needles.
The paralyzation ray, not the death
Yes.
ray that we know so well from the current series where, they shoot somebody, you see their skeleton, and they fall over and die. They have a lower powered version, apparently, at this point, where they can just paralyze you. It's only temporary, but if they shoot you again, that paralyzation is permanent.
Yes, that was awesome. But I mean, we do get to see the Daleks in true form later on.
And it was cool, though, to see the Daleks, right? We get to see the Daleks for the first time, and
Yes.
they pretty much look like the Daleks do now, which was kind of cool. Their voices are pretty much the same. I'd say a little bit harder to understand. There was some scenes where, the Daleks were talking back and forth to each other, and I really couldn't understand what they were saying.
And I think, if I remember correctly, there were actually two voices, two guys voicing the Daleks on this one. So that might have been where the difference came in. But everything, they look pretty much the same. Yeah, they're a little bit rough around the edges. They look pretty much like the Daleks we'd remember. The one thing is kind of how they function. There were a lot of differences in how they move, kind of where they get their power from. That's where they kind of departed from what we know.
Right, they're basically powered by static electricity, which is
Yeah,
interesting.
they're like those little race cars that you would have on a track growing up where you like pull the trigger on the remote control, and as long as they're touching the racetrack, they can move. But as soon as you disconnect them from the racetrack, well, they're pretty much useless. And that's kind of what it seemed like with the Daleks. As long as they kept their base on the floor, everything was fine. But as soon as something happened there, they were no good.
Yeah. And apparently they were able to kind of advance themselves between now and when they meet the Ninth Doctor in the future, and they're able to just fly around. They can fly upstairs, and then obviously in every episode we've seen since then, the Daleks can basically fly. So they learned from their mistakes apparently, and now no longer run off of static electricity,
Yes, good
which
for them.
is a good thing. They're evolving. That's good to see in a species.
Yep, and that's what their goal always was.
So another thing that I thought was interesting in this episode was Susan explaining why she had to go back to the TARDIS because only she knew how to go to use the key correctly, because if you don't use the key correctly in the TARDIS, the lock itself will melt. And I was like, wow, that is interesting. They've never, I mean, I don't know if they ever use that again in other episodes going forward, in other classic Doctor episodes, but that's definitely not the way the lock works in the modern series. You know, he basically gives somebody a key and they can get in whenever they want.
Yeah, I think that's just another sign of the Doctor that has no friends. He's kind of wanting to be by himself, and as long as him and his granddaughter can access the TARDIS, everything is good. But I thought that was odd too, that she makes a pretty big deal about, you have to make sure you do this right or the lock will melt and we'll never be able to get in again.
Yeah, because the locksmith that they know is back on Gallifrey.
And they aren't exactly welcome there yet. And they're on a planet they can't really get off of without the TARDIS.
Right. So Susan does go back to the TARDIS. And that's our first time that we get to see the Thals. They show up. The guy shows up. He's got his Ninja Turtle cape on. And he tries to make friends with Susan. And their outfits are completely ridiculous. I'm going to say that.
Yep.
They have these giant capes that look like turtle shells, in my opinion. And then they, you know, have these vests that are like poofy vests, kind of. But they don't really fit them that well.
Yeah, they're like V-shaped poofy vests.
And then they don't have any shirts underneath. So it's interesting. Yeah. It's an interesting choice of style. But, you know.
Yeah, looking at them, they're definitely fans of the letter V. It looks like they're active advertisement for Sesame Street. The letter of the day is letter V.
I did not notice that. I mean, I noticed the V shape, but I didn't take it that far. I didn't go into the Sesame Street, you know, realm.
I was using it as a teaching method for my children. I'm sorry. If daddy's watching this episode, you will watch too and you will learn.
So Susan decides to trust the Thals. I think at this point they kind of go back to the city. We get to see Ian. He's starting to recover, and then we get a scene where they actually, I thought this was very interesting, that they decide to take on the Daleks, and you get to see Ian like attack a Dalek, and there's a little bit of hand-to-hand combat, which is something that we never see with the Daleks. You know, anytime we've seen the Daleks face off against anyone in the modern series, they pretty much keep their distance, they shoot their lasers at you, or maybe at the most they're going to come up to you and suction your face with their plunger thing.
Yes.
But having him actually kind of attack a Dalek was different. You know, it's almost comical to see him jump on the back of this giant Dalek.
It wasn't only him, though. It was everybody. Everybody went after the poor little Dalek. They used the Ninja Turtle cloak that the Thal gave to Susan, and they found out that if it's not touching the floor, well, guess what? The Dalek can't move. So they went ahead and disrupted all of that, and yeah, it was a pretty interesting scene as all of them are jumping all over him and climbing all over him. But what really gets me is kind of what happens next.
They scoop that Dalek right out of there.
Yeah, they pop it open like a trash can. They lift the lid and they reach in with a cloak and they don't even bother to really check to see what's on the inside. It all happens pretty quick. They just rip them right out and they throw them on the floor covered by the cloak.
Which is kind of like, oh man, they didn't even take into account that maybe that Dalek needed that apparatus to live. You know, they're just like, oh, let's just put him on the floor and he'll be okay.
They're very much concerned, which we find out even later in the episode. They just want to get out of there.
That's true.
So after they rip the Dalek out, that was surprising enough. But now that the shell, if you will, is empty, I guess the only logical thing is to have someone climb inside and try to pilot the Dalek. What did you think of that?
I thought it was very convenient that the Daleks designed their vehicles to be able to house a human being. You know, that there was enough space inside of there for a large human being like Ian to actually fit. He did say it was a little tight on his legs, I think. But yeah, so that was kind of interesting there. You know, he gets in there, he says, I don't know how to drive this thing. So they just push him. But then quickly he learns how to drive it, which he's apparently a quick study on how to control a Dalek from the inside.
He's also pretty good at imitating their voice. He got it down pat pretty quickly.
Definitely. So I think at this point we get kind of like Susan has come back with the Thals. They have come to help get her friends. Or I guess they kind of think they can come and make peace with the Daleks if they just speak to them. They're going to make peace with them.
The
And
Daleks have offered them food and help, and hey, this will be a wonderful partnership.
So they come there, but it all turns pretty bad. The Dal or the Thals leader is actually killed by the Daleks. And the Daleks, their firing mechanism or whatever special effect that they're using for when they shoot people is really odd.
Yeah.
I don't know what, it's kind of weird. They like change the color of the screen and then they show like some kind of weird thing happening and then all of a sudden somebody falls down like they got shot.
Yeah, it looks it, honestly, like every time I saw it, it looks like poorly developed film. It's like at that point in time, they decided to take the filming reel and switch it to a negative and let the heat of the camera crackle it a little bit. It's just that kind of like weird negative bubbly looking effect. But yeah, we know one thing, the Daleks are very effective now at killing.
Yes, they are. So I guess they get out of there though, right? Ian and Barbara and Susan and the doctor and some of the Thals, they escape, they get back to the Thals camp. Then they realize they realize that they can't leave because Ian forgot the one little part that they need to actually fly the TARDIS.
Yep, the doctor's plan backfired on him.
So
The doc.
The whole reason that the doctor, they went to the city because the doctor lied to them. Rule number one, the doctor lies. And he tricks them into going to the city because they think they need this part that they don't actually need. But then all this happens with the Daleks and then they lose the part. So the entire trip to the city was completely pointless in the first place, but then it became even more pointless because they still can't leave. So they got to go back to the city.
And mind you, that was the first four episodes, I believe. The first four, the episodes of this series. All of them just for naught now.
Yeah, so and I, at this point I was kind of like yelling at Ian. I'm like, seriously? Because I was ready for this to be over. Okay, you met the Daleks, you escaped the Daleks, only one Thal died. Happy ending, they fly away to the next planet. But no, they got to go back. So they decide that, well, I guess the Thals themselves are pacifists, right?
Yeah, we find that out. All of them are ready to cut their losses. One person's dead, couple injured. No use. Disappointed that the Daleks aren't really as friendly as they thought they were, and they're just gonna pack up, head to the plateau, and hope that the Daleks don't find a way to get away from the city.
And Ian's like, no, we need these people, right? And
Yeah.
this is another problem I have with this episode is like the doctor, who no, who is it's actually the doctor and Barbara who are want to manipulate these people so they can use them to go fight the Daleks. Whereas Ian was more on the side of we shouldn't be taking advantage of these people.
Going back to that whole scene, Ian is wanting to convince them to help or to fight so that they can just fight the Daleks because they don't really have any hope anyways, and they're gonna die one way or the other. So face your fears, attack, and don't be wimps. The doctor is thinking, who cares? We need them to fight to help us. So both of them were really just wanting the Thals to offer themselves up as a sacrifice so they could get their end goal. It's just Ian had slightly more of a long-term goal for the Thals themselves as opposed to just reclaiming the fluid link.
Yeah, it seemed like Ian was more compassionate to the fate of the Thals and was trying to encourage them to defend themselves. I felt like that was the way he was going about it, as opposed to the doctors just wanting to use them just to get off the planet, and he didn't necessarily care about their fate.
Yeah.
Eventually, the Thals agree to help them, sneak into the city. So they go through, what, at this point, is this where they like split up?
Yeah, so they decide. So we learn from the history of the Thals, which they decide to share with the doctor during the interim of trying to figure out what they're going to do, that they used to be warriors. So once Ian convinces them that it's in their best interest, first by trying to steal their history, which is all bound up in a nice little container, which doesn't work. So he decided to take one of the women, which believe it or not, works, and the leader socks him in the face. Then the Thals are like, oh yeah, it might be a good idea to fight. I feel bad about what I did, but this might be in our best interest. But then they decide that the best plan would be to, I guess, divide and conquer. Have a distraction at the front gate and try to find a way in through the back. The only problem is they don't really know how to get in the back.
Yeah, at this point I was kind of confused too about the length of time that it was going to take them, because I feel like the first time they went to the city, Ian was like, he said something about it only taking a couple hours. But then when they go the back way through like the bog and the caverns and all this stuff, it was going to take like 2 days. Isn't that what they said?
Yeah, they said that they had 2 days to meet up with the doctor. So
there's got to be a better way. I mean, it's a pretty big city. And so maybe have the doctor go to the front gate. They could go the same way as the doctor, but then split up and go to the side gate. I don't know.
Like, yeah, because it definitely didn't seem like they had an issue getting into the city for the first time. It's not like there were guards.
Yeah, they just walked right in these doors that opened for them. But this time they have to go through some secret back entrance that had to go through this bog that has like crazy whirlpool and monsters that kill people. And then they go through a cavern that has chasms that you have to jump across. Like, I was like, man, this is, I don't know. That was a little, the long way around, the scenic route.
Yeah, it was definitely the scenic route, especially since they had really no idea where they were going. In the interim, we see one Thal die at the Lake of Mutants, which I guess has a backstory that other people have died there before. So some people were worried, but they weren't allowed to talk about it. So they didn't worry everybody else who had no idea what that place was. So one person dies there. And then we find out that there's a Thal in the group that doesn't really believe in what they're trying to accomplish. And he tries to go back. His brother convinces him to stay. Well, he ends up dying in the caverns as well, dangling from a rope that he ends up cutting himself because he couldn't hang on to a rope that was tied to himself.
Yes. And one of the most pathetic death scenes I have ever seen on television. He can't, like, everybody else jumps across this chasm just fine.
Including Barbara.
Including Barbara. He jumps across and, I don't know, he like bounces off the wall and falls backwards or something.
Yeah, mind you, he has a rope tied to him.
Yes, he has a rope around his waist. Okay, so he falls down into the cavern and, you know, it's a deep enough chasm that if he didn't have the rope, he would have fallen to his death. But he quickly, you know, Ian is clawing onto the side for dear life, trying to hold on. And he's telling this guy, you know, get your feet on the wall, you know, take some pressure off of me. And the guy's just down there panicking. And he's like, I can't hold on. And I'm thinking, you have a rope around your waist. You don't have to hold on to anything. It's holding you. You know, so this was the most pathetic Thal by far. And then he just, like you said, he decides to just end his own life by cutting the rope, which in turn probably saved Ian's life. So, you know, we appreciate that, but yeah, it was pretty pathetic.
Yeah, and so while that group is wandering through the cave in the darkness because their light source dies, and then the flashlight that they had ended up dying, we have the Dr. Susan and a couple others who are trying to make it to the front gate, and the doctor and the Susan find a power source. So the doctor pulls out what I think was a plumbing wrench, which I have no idea where he got the plumbing wrench now that I think about it. But he pulls out a plumbing wrench and he starts shattering glass and breaking circuits.
Yeah, with a pretty big smile on his face. He was pretty proud of himself with that.
He definitely felt like he was having it definitely looked like he was having a clever doctor moment.
Yeah. So he's shorting out the electricity. I guess the thought behind that is that if they can cut off the electricity, that they will cut off the power to the Daleks. Although it doesn't really make sense, because if the Daleks were running off of static electricity, then electricity running through cables shouldn't matter.
You would think,
but you know. So that was interesting, but then of course they get captured.
But in the meantime, we have the one group going through the caverns. We have the other group trying to find their way through the front gate, and the doctor's breaking stuff. You have the Daleks inside the city who find out that the anti-radiation medicine that they stole from Susan when she got back from the TARDIS the first time, that that is actually dangerous to them, and they start dying off. So they decide the only way for them to survive would be to let off radiation into the air and irradiate the entire planet a second time.
So only they could live.
So that only they would live and everybody else would die. So if you're following along at home, you have people in a cave wandering, trying to find their way out because now it's pitch black and they have no idea where they're going. You have people at the front gate that used to be open, but now for some reason they have trouble getting inside of it, and the doctor's smashing things with a wrench. And then you have the Daleks inside dying, and then they decide, you know what, let's just kill everybody in the first place by using radiation.
And the longest countdown ever.
It's a race against the 100-second countdown clock.
But luckily, Ian finds a hole in the wall. In the cave, he sees the light, and he's actually realizes that through this hole, they can actually get right into the city, right? Yep,
exactly. The flashlight dies, and lo and behold, sunlight peeks through the wall.
So they get in there. We get to see some more hand-to-hand combat with the Daleks. This time it's with the Thals. The Thals are literally jumping all over the Daleks.
And a few of them die here and there.
Oh, yeah. The Thals were dying left and right.
Yep.
Pretty much they get the Doctor and Susan out of there.
Yeah. They free the Doctor and Susan, and the countdown's still going. And yes, the countdown started at 100, and we were able to hear the countdown from 100 until it gets to 3. And this entire time, Daleks are getting smashed, and Thals are getting shot, and people are flying every which way. And we get to 3, and it just stops.
I guess the Doctor, because of the stuff that he broke with his wrench, there was some kind of a delayed reaction, but I'm guessing that because of what he did is what stopped the Daleks from working. Is that kind of how you read it?
Yeah, so it's like there was a capacitor in this city that had stored up all this power, and then by the time they got counted down to 3 and all this battle and stuff took place, the Daleks didn't have anything else to run on, and we get one more thing from the Daleks as they one more saying by the Daleks as they die and really wishing that they had Energizer batteries.
So wait, this capacitor thing, are you making that up or was
I'm just
I...
making that up.
Okay,
I'm just thinking of a way that they could store energy that would be a slow release.
So the Daleks I guess are dying because their electricity is turned off. The Thals that survived get out with the Doctor and them. They all go back to the camp, and then everybody's happy. The Doctor and the companions get back into the TARDIS, and now they have the part that they need and they can leave. My problem with this episode is the story was somewhat interesting, but the whole premise of why they had to do everything that they did and why so many people died was because of the Doctor lying. He's the bad guy in this situation, in my opinion.
Yeah, he definitely is the cause of the situation. They honestly, within the first episode, probably 10 minutes in, all of them had already decided, you know what, we don't like this place. All the trees are petrified. There's weird metal lizards hanging around places. And Susan just got touched on the shoulder by who knows what. Let's just get out of here.
Let's leave, yes.
And it's the Doctor who puts his foot down and says, no, I'm a man of study, and I see a city that I want to take a look at.
Yep. And because of his curiosity and his willingness to lie to his companions, many Thals died.
Yes. Many, many Thals died in the making of this movie, in the making of this episode. And the Daleks, from the looks of it, were completely disabled, possibly.
Yeah. So maybe this is the first time that the Doctor has destroyed the Daleks. And we know he'll do it many more times. But but the Thals seemed to be okay with the Doctor. They were all friends at the end. They weren't mad.
They asked him to stay.
Yeah, they wanted him to stay and be like their, advisor on how to thrive as a culture. And I was like, man, really, this is the guy you want to try to take advice from? He just caused the death of your comrades. So many of them innocent. That was my issue with it. All in all, the story was interesting. It was way too long, in my opinion. 7 episodes to tell this story. A pretty simple story, but I think that's just kind of the way serialized TV used to work, and it's probably something we're going to have to get used to if we're going to be continuing to you know, go through these classic Doctor episodes. But, you know, all in all, it was cool to see the Daleks, to see kind of the history of the Daleks and the history of Skaro, meet this new species, the Thals. I think we're going to see them again based on stuff that I was looking at. They're going to come back for, I think, the third and fourth Doctors have run-ins with the Thals again. So some really, really bad acting. The story definitely got boring at points. But as a research project to kind of see the history of the Doctor and the Daleks, in my opinion, it was worth going through these seven episodes. What do you think?
I would say to kind of get my footing on who the classic Doctor is, or at least where the Doctor began, being able to see the Daleks and kind of enjoy them for who they were and kind of who they still are. It was fun. There are definitely rough spots on these episodes. There are things that really don't make much sense. The Doctor is not the Doctor that I am used to. He is dramatically different. And the companions aren't the types of companions I'm used to. They are dramatically different. Still an interesting watch, though. I'm still amazed at how deep Doctor Who goes, how much is wrapped up in even the modern Doctor episodes that we watch. Everything has links. There's ties to everything, be it Skaro, be it the Daleks. Even I believe in the episode where we meet see the Daleks for the first time with Eccleston, they run up the stairs, and when the Dalek starts flying, he says, "Oh, that's new," if I'm remembering correctly. So just how they've changed, how they evolved, wasn't my favorite Doctor Who experience, but I would say it was definitely worth watching with all the kind of, if I can call it that, the history wrapped up in it.
Yeah, it's definitely a fun journey. I think the classic Doctor episodes are kind of more for people who, if you've watched all of the modern series and you're looking for something else, you know, you're looking to fill out your knowledge about the Doctor, the classic Doctor episodes are kind of for those type of diehard fans. You know, if you really want to know everything, if you want to see every Doctor and as many episodes as you possibly can see, those type of fans will be able to stomach it. I could definitely see fans that are, you know, people that are fans of the current series, and if they try to go back to the classic episodes, it's just so different that I could see a lot of people not really be able to handle it.
You wanted advice, you said. I never give it, never. But I might just say this to you. Always search for truth. My truth is in the stars, and yours is here.
Well, our next classic episodes that we're going to be jumping into is a series called The Edge of Destruction. And it looks like there's only two episodes in that. That should be interesting.
Yeah, we kind of saw a glimpse of that at the very last moment in the end of these episodes when they jump in the TARDIS, they start to fly away. There's a big flash and everybody falls to the ground.
All right, well, I think we can go ahead and wrap this episode up. What do you think?
Sounds good to me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Bad Wolf Radio. So as always, you can find us on iTunes, and if you haven't left us a review yet, we would definitely appreciate leaving a review on iTunes for us. You can also follow us on Twitter at Bad Wolf Podcast, Facebook, where we have quite a few likes now. I think we've passed 800 now. Adam, did you know that?
I did. It's something that I keep an eye on. There's a few goals that I have in mind. So, hey, all the likes help. We like to reach our goals.
Yeah, so 800 likes so far, and, you know, we'd like to reach 1,000. That'd be nice. So if you haven't liked us yet over there on Facebook, go ahead and do that. But we don't just want your like, you know. Interact with us on Facebook. We have a nice community over there on our Facebook page where, you know, we'll post things and people that listen to the show will reply to us and we get some nice conversation going on over there. So if you haven't checked out our Facebook page yet, go ahead and head over there and give us a like.
In fact, I think our Facebook page had the Doctor's outfit very, very soon after it was posted to everybody.
Yeah, we try to keep on top of the news. We're not always the first to break it, but, you know, we're pretty quick on getting stuff out there. So, yeah, as things break, you can look on our Facebook page and we'll be posting about it and hopefully having conversations about it over there as well. And if you just want to send us an email, we definitely would welcome that. badwolfpodcast@gmail.com. Send us an email with your feedback about these episodes. What do you think about us talking about the classic Doctors? Do you wish that we weren't talking about the classic Doctors? You know, let us know what you think. We definitely would love to hear your feedback so we can take that into account as we're recording these episodes. Or if you just have some opinions of your own about Doctor Who, let us know and maybe we'll even read your email on the air. So until next time,
later days.